Hi, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different article, and we get the writer of that article onto the podcast to talk about their article and the craft of interactive writing, which you probably know at this point. But if you don't, and this is your first episode, that is what we're doing, and that is why we do it. This week, I'm really thrilled to have a friend of mine, Graham Walmsley, on to talk about his work, which is a little bit different than most of the people we've spoken to so far, but I won't put any spoilers in, and I'll ask him instead. Graham, hello. Good evening. How are you?
Hi. I'm really good. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Really looking forward to it.
Good. We're absolutely delighted to have you on. For the benefit of our listeners, could you please just start off by telling us a little bit about who you are, what you do, what kind of writing are you involved with? How do you sit into the cornucopia of game writers?
That's going to take up 45 minutes to answer all those questions.
That sounds good to us.
Yeah.
I'll get a cup of tea.
I'm Graham Walmsley. I'm a tabletop game designer. I'm going to open by saying it's a bit like Dungeons & Dragons, and then I'll spend the next 10 minutes going, it's nothing like Dungeons & Dragons. It's actually much broader than that. I'm a tabletop game designer, best known for a game called Cthulhu Dark, which is a rules light horror game. You can Google it. There's a 2-page version which you can play for free, and then there's a book which you should buy. But it's not just that. I do a sort of whole range of weird little games. I've done queer history games. I've done a game about the history of disco. I've done murder mystery games where you don't know who the murderer is until the end of the game. I've done a load of weird stuff as well.
This is fabulous, because that very range is, I think, just the vein we want to explore and tap into a little bit here. And you've given us a great entry point. So your article for the Kaleidoscope is very excitingly titled, Let's Make an 80 Days Tabletop Role-Playing Game. So you have given us your thesis right there in the title, but if you wouldn't mind, carry us through a bit of what your article was and the conclusion you came to.
Yeah, partly it just seemed like a deliciously cheeky title, and I wanted to go with it. I wanted to explore the difference between interactive fiction and tabletop role playing games, which in a way I only know half of, right? Because I've dipped my toe into interactive fiction, and that's about it. But I wanted to explore it, and rather than writing a sort of fairly dull theoretical article, I thought we'd take 80 days and go, what would happen if we turned this into a role playing game? And of course, having written that. That article, I then went away afterwards and went, actually, there's about 3 or 4 different ways. There's different choices you could make here about how you would create 80 days into a role-playing game. And there's so many different things you could do. It's such an interesting thought experiment.
Very much so, yeah.
So we know each other off this podcast anyway, and we've talked about tabletop design many times. But as you know, I'm fairly a novice when it comes to the tabletop world. I've done a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons, but as you say, that's quite a limited palette of the breadth of tabletop design. And I think I have nothing but questions always when I encounter kind of tabletop design as to how the design interfaces with the players, I guess, because the design to me seems so gentle and so kind of miniature, almost minimalist. That's the word I'm looking for. But the game that plays is so, in a way, maximalist and broad. And I just have a billion questions. So I should start with one, which is, you were talking about 80 days in your article and the idea of turning that into a tabletop game. And 80 days is a challenging one to start with because it's such a big, broad world of a game. So my first question was, how do you capture the flavor of a world in your, obviously your games are very flavorful. Cosmic Dark is, very flavorful. Cthulhu Dark's very flavorful. How do you, because that's something I can't quite grasp, I think, in the design process, that I can see that you're writing a rule book, but obviously you can't detail all the cities in the world of 80 days. You can't give layers and layers and layers of world building facts and facts and facts. That's not going to work. But then I don't think you'd even want to do that. So somehow you have to get across the sense of tone. Otherwise, it's not really an 80 days game. It's just a world and people can put whatever they like in it. So how do we bottle that in a way that players will understand it? Like, how do we even begin to think about that question? It boggles my brain completely. So I would love to hear you talk about that a bit.
Yeah. And I think it's even a step more complicated than we might think, right? Because with a computer game, you're sort of presenting your world pretty directly to people. Mm. And there is a bit of people can choose their own experience, but at the same time, there's quite a lot of your vision in there. And I think the really interesting thing about tabletop role-playing games is that, of course, I'm not going to play directly with people. I'm sort of giving people rules and then they build on top of that. And so it's another step of indirection. Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? there is something about... let's go back to 80 days, right? If we are sitting around a table and playing an 80 days role-playing game, and we want to make sure that this role-playing game is, it's going to tell an 80 days story, right? It's not going to tell a James Bond story or anything like that. Mm. I think part of the way we do that is with prompts. So you were sort of saying, you could have descriptions of each of the cities. You could, we could have a little pack of cards, right, that has a city on each of them. And I think that's part of it. I mean, if you say, all right, we're now in the city, the walking city of Agra, you see this sort of vast walking city coming towards you, and you get on board. Where do you want to go? Do you want to go to the upper levels, or do you want to go to the lower mechanical levels? Then I feel, we could even do some more specific things, right? Do you want to go to the engine room, which is you can barely talk, but you can barely hear yourself think, but the engineers are down there and they might have things to talk to you? Or do you want to go to the upper deck and look where the walking city is going? I think instantly, if I give you those two prompts, you could take them in different directions, but you're probably going to take them in a direction which would fit in the 80 days world.
So I get the feeling, listening to you describe that example, I mean, yes, what you're doing is working, right? My brain is going, oh yeah, I can imagine it. And I get the kind of, it's funneling me into the right sense. But what seems magical about it, like to the point at which it almost feels unfair compared to the kind of writing that I'm used to, is that every word becomes so incredibly precious. Like, you don't say very much, but what you say must really matter, right? Because if you, like, to take the extreme counter example, if you mess up a little bit and say the walking city of Agra, which is powered by nuclear fission, you would never do this, obviously, then suddenly the tone has fallen on the floor and broken, or at any rate, it's gone somewhere else. So it feels to me like an incredibly elegant kind of world building. Does that sound like the way that it feels when you're doing it, or are you more carefree about it than that? Am I kind of overthinking this?
I think you're really right, and I think the words you choose can be very important. I mean, let's say you and I are brainstorming like an Agra thing, and we kind of go, well, okay, we can let people go to the engine room, or we can, it might be interesting to have an armory. Let's send them off to the armory. And then we play this game, and we find that suddenly everyone picks up weapons in the armory, and it comes into a completely different kind of story. So yeah, there is something about, giving people exactly the right prompts to steer them in the right direction. I love the idea of the words being precious. I think that's right.
It's like there's an incredible amount of negative space going on as well, or something like that. Like the fact that if you say there's the engine room, the armory, and the casino, that is a completely different setting than the engine room, the armory, and the pleasure dome, or the engine room, the armory, and the poetry corner. Like these are all, they're almost spinning entirely new sub-universes off at the choice of one word. I'm slightly in awe of this process. Like, are we in control of this process? Is it done on vibes? How logical?
You're not totally
in
control of the process. So this is the thing, right? So, I mean, we're not really presenting an experience to give to people. We're, and I find this fascinating, we are kind of giving people tools to create their own experience. I think this is one of the most fascinating things about, well, for me, about tabletop RPGs, is that you want to leave that room so that players design their own world, and they go, I designed this totally new location for 80 days. It was amazing. It was this, you know, giant ice flow like an ancient turtle which dived under, and you know, and you, yeah, you want to leave space for people to do that.
So I guess, sorry, Saga. I guess when we were making 80 Days, I suppose we were doing something a bit like that, in that when we'd come up with a location, we'd have a sense of, okay, what are we going to put in this location? What would be 80 days-ish to put in this location? But that process was never formalized. We just kept inventing things. So is there an element to which, if you're writing this rule book for this notional game, you have to somehow formalize that sense of,
yeah, yeah,
what makes a location 80 days-ish? But how do you go about doing that? I don't... Like, I built the whole game, then I don't know how to do that. How do you start?
I mean, first of all, I do think all of this is possible, right? I don't think it's, in a way, I don't think it's something, you know, we should be in awe of. I think we can do it. It's really interesting how these tools work. I mean, to segue to a different example, right? I wrote for the Doctor Who role playing game, and I wrote the John Pertwee book. Which was pretty much because I really wanted to write for it. And I thought, who's a doctor that I kind of want to write, but I don't think everyone else is going to pitch for? And I went, John Pertwee, you'd be fascinating. And so what I did was I watched every John Pertwee episode, and I pulled out all the little bits of all the little tricks that they did, right? You know, I mean, sometimes just on a very basic level, you know, that there's a lot of martial arts. There's sometimes they go really quite deep into things like peace conferences or something like that. They don't hold back from saving the world. It's all action adventure. And so I think that's, in a way, that's what you do. So you want to teach people to tell a particular type of story. And the first thing is to look at the story you've got and take it apart and go, well, what are we doing here? So, you know, 80 days, right? If you're designing a city in 80 days, there's always choices of place to go. There's always some sort of resonances of class in there. And the places to go give you the resonance of class. You know, you're in Paris, you can go to restaurants, or you can go. So I'd be sort of picking it apart and sort of, I don't know.
So that leads me on to another question, which is, obviously, with the Doctor Who example is great, because I can really imagine that process of kind of taking the existing content and kind of distilling it down. If you're building something new, what does that look like then? Is there more of a back and forth between the kind of the setting text? What's that generating in games? Is that what I want? Tweaking the setting text, or do you have more of a sense of, I mean, do you effectively develop an episode of the TV show that you want the players to ultimately generate, then describe the thing that you've generated? How does that work for you when you're trying to working with IPs that aren't as well defined as Doctor Who?
I think if it's not IP that's not as well defined, then, I mean, you know, there's still stuff to read. I would read my way deeply into it and sort of work out what the author's doing and stuff like that. You did say something interesting there, actually, which is that I do find it quite, in a way, quite difficult to write my own worlds. And I feel I'm always like basing them on something or some sort of story. And if there's one thing I'm slightly in awe of, is, I mean, you know, if I look at games like Highland Song, I sort of sit there going, oh, right, you tried to write this kind of story, which I wouldn't even know how to write. It's apparently about getting lost in the Scottish Highlands, but there's a sense of dread because, you know, it could be really dangerous. And it's, yeah, I mean, that's writing new sorts of story, I find quite hard, if I'm honest.
You know, I think part of maybe where we might be getting stuck, John, with the approach of questions that we're having is that there are certain things that we tend to do, I think, in video game writing a little bit more than you get in TTRPG writing. And there are two particular things that come to mind. And one is of the genre we almost become too specific. Like the medium of tabletop RPGs is so big and so vast, right? That a number of them absolutely are adaptations of existing works. And then I think you would go through a process that's very much like what you're saying, Graham, right? Where you will go deep into what that world is. For example, in 80 Days, right? Let's say you're designing a city and you want that to feel authentic. Well, there's a bunch of cities in the game, 80 Days, right? You could stack them all up together and say, how do these all fit? Which ones are cities? Which ones are settlements? Which ones are towns? Mm. When you are making a new one, what are the characteristics of it? I really like the publisher Free League. I love the way that they kind of do a lot of their work. And it's amazing how explicit they are actually at the beginning of a new game. This game is about these five things. It is very common for in this sort of Spielbergian setting of Tales from the Loop that the parents are around, the adults are around, but they can't solve your problems. It is always important that there's some sci-fi setting, but it's always in the background to the mundane. You're always like, so they're really specific about like, well, what are the things that make that genre or that style of game? Because of what you said, I think, John, right? That like they don't quite know. But the second thing, and the thing I want to ask you about, Graham, is that when you are writing a rule book, there is that layer of abstraction that you yourself just referred to, that you, it's not just that you're writing for people to make their own stories, but you're not even writing for the players, right? You're writing for the slightly more involved, educated audience of GMs who are going to then take your work and deliver it to players, right? Like, unless of course you have a player handbook. Could you tell us a bit about that? Like, do you find yourself writing to the person who's going to lead the game, who's going to lead the structure? Or do you find yourself writing a bit more generally?
That's so hard. I always try to write as much as possible for the players. So I always try to rely as little as possible on that GM figure and just sort of throw the rules out to the players as far as I can. I'm also a bit of a fraud when I say that, because I do like writing, you know, stories for, you know, a with GM to lead someone. Yeah, I do. I do love that whole idea of when I'm a player of sort of wading through someone else's mystery. I do like all of that. You brought something up. I mean, rules, I think, are really interesting. And I mean, rules in tabletop role-playing games and how you use dice and numbers to sort of just push narrative in a particular direction. You were talking about Free League games, and they did a game of The Walking Dead, which is great. And just as a very simple example of how you can use dice to push a game in a particular direction, that they have a rule that, you know, if occasionally if one of your horror dice or something, whatever it's called, rolls high, you roll on the zombie table, and it creates this wonderful effect where, you know, it's all quiet. You're just, you know, you're exploring this place you found and you just pick this lock and there's a zombie and it's, you're dead. And that is completely in genre for The Walking Dead. Things just, but just as a very simple example, I find it fascinating the way you can use dice to kind of just push the story in particular directions. That's one of my most fun things.
It's like we have choices about things, it's like you were just saying, John, right? It's like the tabletop RPG writer has a choice of framing that is incredibly powerful, right? The choice of, say, what character classes you suggest or offer to the player, you're not stopping them. They could kind of do anything. But even in your article, you were like, well, perhaps we have a bunch of characters who are part of Phileas Fogg's group of servants. But they can't just be anyone, right? You were like, it would not be an 80 Days game if they were a military squad. Like they would need to fit a certain structure, and you can lead the player on that journey in the writing that you're doing, right? I wonder if you could talk actually a little bit about that. Why, for example, it might not be as fun to be Fogg in this case, or it might not be as fun to be Sherlock in a game that's set in that type of universe. How do you decide which character classes, so to speak, or roles or jobs make most sense?
How do you decide who's the most fun to play? Partly you're grabbing from the fiction, right? You know, you're kind of, although 80 Days is kind of a bad example of that. I don't know. I'm actually slightly stuck on that question. I think there is a thing, isn't it, that Sherlock Holmes stories are rarely written from the point of view of Holmes. And I wonder if playing these sort of super powerful characters is actually as interesting as it seems. You want the feeling.
Unless that's what the game is about, right? Like if you're making a supers game and you want to have very, very powerful characters, it's all about their powers and their weaknesses, I suppose, right? And you would just need to have a little bit of both. City of Mist was a game I played with someone recently that like did this, I think, particularly well. They kept you sort of tied to reality despite what superpowers you had, or there was always some fatal flaw or something like that. But
There has to be something, doesn't there? I mean, there has to be, you know, the characters have to have, they have to have things they care about. They have to have, you know, they have to have some sort of weakness, some way that they could, you have to believe that they could be beaten down, I think.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that when we're defining the characters in the rule book, or kind of offering characters to the player, we need to be already thinking about, I don't know how to phrase it exactly, burying like drivers of narrative into those character setups from the off. And potentially doing that in quite a subtle way so that people don't even notice that's what's happening? Or do we do it in a very explicit way and say, like, your character is going to be someone who loses their temper really easily with catastrophic effects? Like, or is that just a stylistic choice?
There's different ways you can do it, right? So, I mean, you can do the thing where you go, okay, we're playing the 80 days role-playing game. Here is your character card. You're playing Passepartout. Here are the three things. That's a really quite nice way to set it up. Or we can do the sort of subtler thing where we go, okay, we're playing the 80 days role-playing game. Which city are we starting in? Okay, we're starting in London. Why has your character always wanted to travel the world? What's one thing that they're really hoping they'll find on the way? What's a problem that they're hoping they'll solve? So you can, you can push it both ways.
You can even be explicit on the mechanics, right?
Sorry, I was going to say, if you start with a game with a question like, why does your character want to travel the world? I love that question. What a great question for driving the narrative. And if you have an interesting answer, you can bring that into the story in lots of interesting ways. How do we help players answer that question? Do we just assume that players are going to be able to solve that kind of thing? In your experience, can they? Or is that asking a lot? It feels to me like I, as a writer, I would be really scared to write that because I'm not doing my job. I'm asking them to do my job.
That's really fair, actually. And I think there's something, if you ask players a wide open question, that sometimes they just, you kind of get just decision paralysis. And I feel they probably would handle it quite well, but sometimes wide is bad. I mean, if you take a game like Apocalypse World, that's rather beautiful. So it doesn't just say, what does your character look like? It says, choose one of the following looks for your character: disheveled, military. I can't quite remember what it says. But there is a real thing about constraining people's choices, and constraining is quite fun.
And presumably,
powerful, right?
The exact constraint you choose has an enormous effect on the way that players conceptualize the game that they're going to play. Like if you offer, I'm not sure what you just said in your example, I don't know the game, but if you offer kind of, you can be a military person, a scientist, I don't know. I can't think of another example off the top of my head, but that might define a sort of Stargate style game. But then if you say, well, actually you can be a navigator, a pilot, then you might be in a Star Trek universe, which is a very different style of universe just by the choice of the roles that you put at the beginning or something. I find what I'm struggling to conceptualize, I guess, and I'd be really interested to hear about how you think about it, is how you bridge the gap between those ideas you set up and the effect that you get at the end, because obviously it's got to be intentional, right? But it's also, there's so little direct control over, or it feels to me like there's so little direct control over what comes out at the end. How do you know when it's going the way you want it to go?
There is a lot of playtesting.
Sure.
And a lot of the playtesting is... I think it's an interesting conversation we could have about playtesting, which could be very long. But I think a lot of the playtesting is you sort of give these rules and these to the players and these sort of constrained choices, and you see where they go with it. And that's when we realize that, you know, actually this armory that we thought was the best idea, actually just makes everyone pick up guns, and it's a really bad idea. So, I feel that, I mean, that's part of it. There is part of sort of testing it out. but also we're never entirely in control in a tabletop role-playing game, right? You know, there will always be someone who in our 80 days role-playing game decides it's a bit like James Bond and they're going around sunlit locations and, you know, we can push them in a particular direction, but they'll always do it and always have fun with it.
So you have to sort of make your peace with that as a creator, that you're kind of creating a very broad possibility space, because of course you are, because you're not there on the day to tell them they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, you're giving tools for other people to have a good time. And you're trying to put, I like to sort of use the analogy of a ski slope. You're trying to sort of tend them, push them in a particular direction, which is your story. And they'll make choices along the way. You're not trying to like railroad them down this one route. You know, if you're on a ski slope, there's different ways you can go down it, and you can, but you always tend to end up going the same direction. I think that's kind of what we're aiming to do.
Yeah. So the point about constraints, I think, is really powerful, right? Like the constraints of what types of characters you can pick, even what descriptions you have. And when you're doing a role table, when you're writing up, say, that zombie list, that's another way that you can keep the IP alive or keep the tone correct, because you can just keep redoing that list and be like, are these all things that could happen in this universe? Is that how we feel, I suppose, for this, right? And I wonder whether how far or to what extent you use mechanics in this way. John had brought up the example of like, well, maybe we want to be more subtle about someone has the possibility of losing their temper. But of course, you could be really explicit about it, I suppose, right? You could have a barbarian, right? And if you're making a maximalist game that is like D&D or like Traveler or something that is meant to allow a huge range of possibilities, that's one thing. But like in a focus game, would you ever use in your example about Passepartout, for example, like perhaps you could have a bunch of standard stats, but you might have a stat that says patience with your boss, I suppose.
Yeah,
and like
absolutely.
That is a thing that you sort of tick up, right? Have you ever done anything like that in any of your games or use mechanics in a way to cover that story?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's sort of rich with possibility. I mean, if you take a game like Monsegur 1244, and I'm kind of deliberately saying this because it gets us away from this idea of like role-playing games as fighty dungeon games. So Monsegur 1244 is a diceless role-playing game, which is about a group of heretics in Monsegur, and faith is very important in this story. In that the characters, the characters are very directly prompted. They have it's almost like every little thing you have is like a little bit of fiction, which, you know, as game designers, we're like slightly sliding into the player's game. So they can, you know, the game can go which way they want, but actually we're still sliding little pieces into it, and that's going to make them do things. Did I just totally avoid your question? I think I did.
Not at all. I mean,
excellent.
It's just one of these media where you have the ability to iterate so rapidly in the way you were referring to, right? Like you can play test, you can see if something works, you can try a slightly different mechanic, and that freedom, it can be really challenging, but is something that we so often don't have in video game writing, right? Like we often have to make certain decisions and kind of stick with them for the purpose of cost, perhaps, or something like that. But when you land on the right mechanic in tabletop, it's so visceral and it can be so literal. Like I think my entry point, not in my childhood actually, like in my adulthood, was with Dread, and with its Jenga tower of pulling bricks, and it's like a mechanic that is so potent and so intense that it's hard to top it, right? Like for the purpose of what they were trying to do, which was to tell like a B movie horror story with your friends, right? And there again, we come back to, I suppose, the tone of the game that we're trying to do.
Should we just explain Dread?
Please, yes, please go
John,
for it.
Do you know? Do you know Dread?
No, I don't.
Oh, so
go
cool.
Tell me about it.
So, Dread is a horror game by Epidai Ravishol, which is, it uses a Jenga tower. It actually has a lot else going on apart from the Jenga tower. So the way the characters are created is very, it prompts them in particular directions. I think the rule is whenever you do something, you remove a block from the tower. But if the tower collapses, then is it suddenly
kaput.
You're attacked? Something like that.
You're out of the game somehow. Like you are dead, or you insane, or it depends again on like which scenario you're running.
Does each player have their own Jenga tower, or is there one shared Jenga tower?
There's a shared one.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's one point where the story just collapses, and then you deal with the aftermath of it. Oh, you rebuild it. Okay,
yeah,
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
I've also got to mention a game by Alex Roberts called StarCrossed, which also uses Jenga. Do you know this one, Saga?
Yeah, it's good.
Which also uses the Jenga tower, sort of steals the mechanic from Dread. But that's a game about, it's a romance game, and it's about sexual tension, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you play this game and you remove these blocks, and when the tower collapses, you give in to the tension. Yeah. so it, I don't know, it's just lovely repurposing of the mechanic.
So I'm just thinking it through. Sorry, I'm behind you guys, just trying to visualize it. But like the Jenga tower works because it's immediate. It's clearly fair because no one is forcing anything to happen. But it also has a time bomb effect, right? You know, the Jenga tower has to fall, right? It doesn't have any choice about that. Yeah. Whereas if you put it on a D20 or something, something might never ever roll this magic 20 that you need to end the story. Whereas
you could do it with dice, right? Like you could.
Okay,
I mean,
go ahead.
So part of it is the fun of having a Jenga tower, and so there is actually, you know, we could do a thing where we have a D20, and you every time you roll, you have to re-roll if you didn't, if you get less than the roll you had before, and so we can make the numbers go up if we want, but I think a lot of it is trying to. Role-playing games are a social situation, and the Jenga tower gives a focus to that, and we're trying to do that.
That's
really there's another game called 10 Candles, which...
I was going to bring this up, yeah.
Very, I know, yeah. Right. Saga, we're playing a game sometime, right, by the way?
We must do. We truly must do, yes. But 10 Candles is because it came out of the same era, I feel. And it was such like a fecund moment in the TTRPG scene where you were like, you are sitting, like the unique thing about the tabletop is that you are at the table with people that you like, presumably, right? And so you can suspend disbelief much more easily. You have trust in a way that you don't have the antagonistic relationship between the player and the video game that you so often have that we almost have to write for, where they're sort of challenging. It's like they have come together to spend all this time, to have fun together. So there's a willingness to play. Please.
That's interesting. I mean, to what guys do you think of the sort of social context around your games? Because it is something you could do, right? I imagine, kind of go, well, this is, you know, this is going to be played by people who are sort of sitting there playing it together. To what extent do you try and kind of work with that?
It's really interesting, actually. I think that this idea of the collaboration being sort of baked into the design from the beginning, almost as an ethos. Like if you play a tabletop game and you're not feeling collaborative, then it's not going to work at all, and you might as well not bother doing it. It doesn't make sense as a thing to do. Maybe that's generally true. It feels like a big statement, but maybe it's generally true. Whereas with a game, I think people often approach games with a very combative mindset, even narrative games, and say, oh, I want to beat this game. I want to win. I don't want to make any mistakes. I don't want to get it wrong. With 80 Days, one of the things that we really wanted to do is create a game which gave you opportunities to clearly mess your journey up for the fun of it. Like, I want to deliberately miss this train, or like have this fling with a Russian princess, or go and hunt this bizarre creature in the forest, just so that I get to see something of the world. And the idea was that if we just kept putting this in front of the player, eventually they would crack and say, oh, screw the time limit, I just want to explore. And then they could have a great time doing something naughty, essentially. And it worked okay, but I think it required a game of the scale of 80 Days to get people out of the idea that they were supposed to win the game and get there in 80 Days. But I feel like an interesting thing for a tabletop version is if you just put one sentence into the rule book where you say that, like, the 80-day time limit is there, but it's not the most important thing, or that kind of the point is exploration, or characters should be trying to... I don't know how you phrase it exactly, but you can ask people to be in on the joke, or kind of in on the drama in a way that quite explicitly that I've never dared to do in a computer game, to say up front, you should be messing this up now. You should be make a nuisance, push the boundary. Like, we invite players to do it, but it's a struggle every time. And that's quite interesting.
Do you know, it's funny because I have played computer games which do that. They kind of go, well, part of the fun is you fail from time to time. And sometimes my reaction is, I think L.A. Noire did that. Mm. And it was like, is this part of the design that you're going to fail this from time to time? And I was like, no, I want to find out about every single case. Because I'm the worst player. I was like, okay, I'm now going to reload and do it until I do it perfectly. I don't care what your design was.
No, Graham, I actually do. I think you hit the nail on the head earlier, right? Where you were like the type of games that you're making can so well structure what you're doing, and you can just say that to the player. You can say, I have left space here for you to do your right thing. In your article, you say, okay, there's a scene in Paris. We tell them that these cafes are heaving with artists and writers, but we don't need to explain precisely who is where. We can let the players kind of work that out. That sounds exactly right. I used to listen to Austin Walker's Friends at the Table, it's a wonderful sort of podcast for role playing games. They often like mix systems in clever ways, and they have this sci-fi game Counterweight, where maybe they do this in every episode, but they would restate at the start of the game session, the purpose of this game is to do this. You are playing this game well, or we encourage you to. And then they have like five slogans, like do this, do this, do this. And it got to the point where it was a mantra in the heads of the players. They could recite it by heart. And at the end of each episode, they would say, hey, did you do this? XP. Did you do this? XP. Their character progression was linked to whatever tonal things that GM decided to care about. And it's that exact thing that John is talking about, this incredible contract that you can have with someone that feels so distant when we have the layer of the computer screen and the fact that we just don't see them, right? You don't have the human connection that you can have in person or, you know, with friends on a video call.
I'm trying to think of a sort of video game counter example. So imagine games like Skyrim and Avowed, which have these kind of quite big crafting mechanics. Yeah. I feel something with putting those crafting, or something like Red Dead Redemption, you know, where... In a sense, they're sort of saying, okay, we're putting all this stuff in the camp for you. And so we are inviting you to come and spend some time and play cards and craft some stuff and just kind of soak up the vibes as opposed to getting on with the adventure. I don't know. Is there something there about...
Well, it's interesting, that kind of stuff, because I think in a game, a lot of players would start reducing that to its statistics quite quickly. You know, what am I making a relationship number go up by doing this? Am I if I'm crafting, is my armor getting better? Is my horse getting stronger? And if not, why am I doing it? The game players can be very output focused, but they're not 100% output focused. Like if you do it well, you can encourage people into kind of a more let's just hang out kind of space to try and get that ambience. I guess when you're playing a video game on your own, you're very conscious that you might be wasting your time. Whereas I suppose in a role-playing game, any time at the table is not wasted time, right? You're still having a nice time with your friends. I it might be interesting for me to understand that better if I could understand what makes a tabletop game go wrong? Like what can you do in a game that causes people to go, no, actually I'm not having fun and this isn't working. There must be a boundary somewhere. So many,
right?
Yeah. Right. So what do they look like?
I mean, firstly, it depends. Are we talking about as a player or, you know, at what point do I realize my game design has collapsed? Maybe there's a couple of things, right? I mean, you know, if we're playing a game and nobody knows what to do next or they don't understand the rules that, you know, they're sort of, you know, they're kind of just going, I'm actually just bored. I just really don't understand what I'm going to do now. And that's a complete red flag. If people become hyper-focused on the rules as well, so, you know, if people do go down that route of just kind of going, well, you know, this is a game about faith in the 13th century. I'm going to get my faith score up now. What do I have to roll to increase my faith? And at that point, you kind of go, actually, you're not really telling a story anymore, are you? You're just kind of trying to do things with numbers. So that's a bit of a red flag, I think, as well.
I guess I'm kind of imagining in the context of the 80 days example, right? I can imagine better than some, maybe. That I can imagine a terrible version of that game, right? Where the player goes to Paris and they go, right, I'm in Paris. I'm now going to take a train to Berlin. Chuff, chuff, choo-choo. Okay, I'm in Berlin now. Now I'm going to take a boat to here. Chuff, chuff, choo-choo. Now I'm here. And, like, I guess that's a bit being hyper-focused on the win condition or something, and just this sense of, oh, I'm making progress. But I guess also there's something about making it fun along the way or something like that. It has to be, yeah. We're not really here for the progression, actually. The progression is a structure within which the good stuff needs to happen. So we need to make sure that good stuff is forced to happen. Like, do we need to gate the player to stop them progressing, or do they do that for themselves? Like,
you just have to have threads, right? Like threads for them to hook onto, right? Like there are three possible ways they can bounce off of pairs, which is literally how the 80 days design itself works, right? There's multiple ways you can break off. Each one should be tempting, and I just feel like you need this palpable sense that you as the players are creating the story as it's going, and that the GM and the rule set is like helping to manage it, but that's the magic of it, right? The sense that you can do whatever, right? Like they could have said like, oh, I want to go visit my sister's grave in Yosemite or example was. They were delightful examples because you can achieve that in a game like this. Suddenly that becomes, it's like a self-driven goal, right? Like you are establishing for yourself what that is. Is that how you exactly think of it?
Sorry to talk over you, Saga, but that's exactly what's going to happen, right? It's this kind of the beauty of you know, we will say, okay, you're in Paris, you can go to the cemetery, or you can go to the restaurant, and the players will go, no, we're not. I am going over there. I am going up the Eiffel Tower. I don't care if it's built yet. But do you know what I mean? And people, there is something about people will make up their own stories. And that thing you said about visiting your sister's grave seems really important, right? And that's quite a really fun thing you can do that, you know, at the start, we will make these characters for the 80 days role-playing game. And someone will say, I've always wanted to travel my world because I've never known where my sister is in the world. And then over the course of the adventure, you know, they will find where their sister is and then eventually visit her grave or something like that. That's kind of the beauty of it, because the player will invent something which then you can weave into the story. I love all
that. Yes, that's it. I mean, I love that you mentioned this, because I mean, some of the best games I've played have tended to be ones where you do ask for a little bit of input from the player ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You're not just saying, hey, look at this cool book, pick your favorite character class. You're saying, you ask them these pointed questions like you've done. And I love that is a part of, it sounds like, the games that you like to make and run, because those simply become the goals that you design for, right? In the course of your adventure, you write those into it. You know, you have a gap where you're like, some good character moment has to happen here. It has to be resolved here. You don't know what it's going to be. And the players give it to you. They say, this is the thing. This is the thing I want. And you're like, oh, great. Because I had like three things in my mind. I had like an antagonist roaming around, and I knew it needed to be in the Americas. And so perfect. We're in Yosemite. That's where they're going to meet. And there's going to be a climactic scene there. And it just starts to happen in the GM's head pretty automatically. Right?
I think that's really interesting, because I sort of know how to do it in tabletop role-playing games. Do you guys do anything like that, where you kind of solicit input from the player and then you use that to shape the story that comes?
So we've done a little bit of something which sounds like that in some of our adventure games. So the best example is in Heaven's Vault, probably, which is, it's a thing, it kind of wants to tell this kind of story. It's a beginning to end plot, and we want everybody to hit the ending, but we don't really care how they get there. So as you're muddling along, we try to take things the player has done, or just where they happen to go and who they happen to talk to, and use that to kick the plot forward. So if you happen to talk to this person, they'll say, oh, I found this interesting thing in the field. You should go and check that out. But we don't specify what it's going to take you to, so that if you ignore it and talk to the other person, they can say, oh, I heard an interesting rumor about a somewhere or other. And actually it's the same clue. It's just in a different place. But that is the next clue. It's just where you happen to go. And then and I feel like that's quite that sort of loosely coupled structure that you're describing. But what it doesn't have, what it can't land, is that wonderful specificity. I don't know how to say that word. The specificness of, oh, you wanted to know about your sister's grave in Yosemite. Bam, this is exactly where the final showdown is happening. I'm going to pull all my threads together at this point, because I can do that, because we're too all over the place. Like, we've got too many little bits of separated data. We can't bring it all together.
It's also that, you know, I think in a way you're digital and I'm doing analog, right? In some sense. So
yeah, absolutely.
Whatever options you give, they will be you know, there might be 16 of them, but there are still 16 discrete options.
Mm. And yeah. The players are very, very aware of that all the time. Yeah. Like nobody ever thinks.
And they try and find the options. Yeah.
And then they say, which one's the best one? And you're like, no, they're all good.
but that's the fundamental difference. I mean, I do sometimes think that the entire video game industry is still an effort at chasing after the wonder you can create at the table. Like, it still feels to me like we are just trying by like making a bigger and bigger and wider game to recreate that moment. And it is nearly impossible to do it, right? Because there, even if you make a very big world, if it is a finite world, you will eventually have a player who figures out that they've reached the end of what this game has coded for them. And there is not much more that they can do with it. Whereas that is never true when you're working with a good GM, right? Like you can always throw something at them and they can catch it and throw it right back at you using the rules and the tone of the world that you're playing in.
No, it's interesting. It's sort of all about inspiring people's creativity. I love all of that. Where, oh my God, I have to tell you this story. There was someone I knew online was walking through a shopping center, and there were two teenage girls on the escalator behind him, and they were saying, "Oh, it's amazing. We there was this star vampire came down, and we did this, and we destroyed the star vampire. It's amazing." And he turned around and said, "Sorry, excuse me, but what are you playing?" And they said, "Cthulhu Dark."
Oh, no way.
I know. I didn't know my game could do that. I've never put a star vampire in my game. But isn't it amazing that, you know, I don't care. I'm not exactly going to be the game police and kind of go, well, actually, I don't think you're playing that quite right. But I'm just so delighted that someone's, you know, someone's inspired. Good.
So, I love that.
Someone's written their own story off the back of it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, the immediacy of it, right? Like you see them liking it or you see them enjoying it. Like what could be more satisfying for a writer or for a creator? I feel that our launches or our big moments, they're so muted sometimes because you get a tweet from someone or something, but you don't get that experience. That feels really special, like the sense of people coming together and enjoying what you've done.
You guys have people who act so amazingly. I mean, Heaven's Vault is a perfect example, right? There's still this community there who are trying to decode the language and get fascinated by it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think my feeling on the long tail of it is more a sort of frustration that the game is limited in the way that it is, because, you know, there are people still kind of digging through the game. And I'm like, well, actually, all the content has been seen now. At launch, there was a long period in which I was very confident that there were things that had never been seen by anyone that were still waiting. But it's all been seen now. Like the box has been thoroughly emptied all over the floor. And that's fine. New people can come in. But there is something gloriously attractive about the idea of creating a world that just runs and runs and runs forever, because it's got this kind of nebulous, never-ending quality to it, which means that it doesn't have a limit. I still find it slightly mind-blowing. You haven't convinced me that it's not magic yet over the course of this hour. I still think it is.
I mean, the only thing, of course, is that it's not me creating the world. I organized a large-scale live-action role-playing game called Marked, which I organized with a woman called Joanna Pincastelli, who is great. It's a lot of work. I don't suggest it. But we had 60 or 70 people playing superheroes in a country house. And I wrote all these things that I was very proud of, these, you know, this kind of backstory, and there was Dr. Mystery who owned the house and so on. I'm saying I, by the way, Joe and I wrote this. And you know, they could discover all these things in the house. During the game, I had no idea what all these people's stories were. And they would come up afterwards and they were, oh my God, we had this whole story in our group. I had no idea at all. And it was just such a lesson for me about, you know, how we kind of do a bit of the prompting, but actually they're doing the work, you know, they're being creative.
Do you think that the fact that you wrote those mysteries was important to making those people do that thing? Like, did you do the right work to create that outcome, do you think, or did you do more than you needed to? Like, what's the moral of that story from a writer's point of view?
The moral of the story, I think, is that when you're writing a LARP, you can't hope to be in control of everything. You can just prompt people in the right direction. But I think we did do a lot which prompted people. So we wrote these sort of amazing characters who all had needs and things, and so they were primed to go out there and have an adventure. And the other thing was we gave it structure. So there were 2 days in this house, and so, you know, the first morning was pretty chill and people getting to know each other and getting to know their teachers. And then in the afternoon, things start happening. This sinister government agency starts setting up shop there. And the tension builds and the tension builds. And I always think there's something about sort of putting these characters in this sort of escalating tension that you don't know which way the story is going to go, but you're creating this situation that you know something's going to burst.
So we've got the setup and then we have something to drive the momentum of the story, and then what story gets told will inevitably be interesting because of those factors.
I think so. It's kind of the setup of most horror games for me, is that you have this, you know, create this little collection of characters, and they're just very human characters who have very human relationships, and then you put them in a situation of escalating horror. And the point isn't really the horror. The point isn't really, you know, what's this thing that's happening? The point is, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, you're putting them under pressure.
What are their options?
Yeah, exactly that.
Fabulous. Well, Graham, why don't we bring things to a close over there? We very much appreciate your time. There's so much more that we could talk about. I wish we had a little bit more time, but perhaps another day. For our listeners, we will, of course, be back next week interviewing another guest from the Kaleidoscope, all about the craft of game writing. Thank you very, very much, and goodbye, everyone.